Okay. Paul Edwards is up, and then Mike Gerson and Karen. And I think Will, when Will starts smiling broadly, I think that's you're raising your hand. Did you raise
your hand? The whole time I was talking.
He smiled the whole time. Over here, Paul Edwards is first here, please.
Thank you both for very informative presentations. Peter, I wanted to respond from, I'm looking at this from, of course, the being at the Deseret News in Salt Lake City, Utah, from how the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has looked at this. And I think it's important that I just want to clarify from their perspective, looking over their statements about immigration, which became very focused in the 2011 year in the state of Utah. There was a lot of discussion about immigration reform. And there was initially the introduction of a bill very similar to what had been presented in Arizona. And the efforts came underway to modify and create a slightly different dialogue in Utah. But the way the Mormon Church talked about immigration in their official statements was in part from an ethical framework. But I think it's interesting to note one of the statements begins with this. It says, as a worldwide church dealing with many complex issues across the globe, and then it goes on into its statement about some different principles. And my experience is that, as much as anything, some of these churches are seeing this just as an organizational issue at a very pragmatic level, so that as they operate a worldwide operation, and they have people that are, in fact, migrating in and out of different countries, that they just experience interesting things within a congregation. How do you deal with the issues of congregational life when you have, you know, parishioners who are undocumented and you're trying to help them with housing and work and those kinds of things? And so I think some of it may be just at a very practical level about how an organization that doesn't see borders in its mission, as a, you know, although recognizing that it operates within those kinds of laws and constraints, just how they deal with some of the practical concerns. And so you may be overstating, you know, the narrative of you know, idealism and refugees and those kinds of things that comes into play when churches are speaking out on certain kinds of immigration issues. And just to put a slightly finer point on that, this has come up significantly with the way that Latter-day Saints deal with missionary service, because as undocumented Mormons come of age to serve as missionaries, just the issue of where they are assigned becomes a very practical concern, because if they are assigned outside of the United States, they can't get back in. And so it creates a real issue for their family. So I think just the practicalities may play a larger role than you gave credit for.
Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge Paul, not only his question, but his help. I met him for the first time when I arrived here 2 days ago, but had interviewed him by telephone a year and a half ago, when I came across an editorial in Deseret News that was talking about illegal immigration and made this really interesting point about how Americans who were upset about illegal immigration were invoking a kind of civil law notion that was quite antithetical to our common law traditions. And I don't know about you, but I don't see too many allusions to that kind of discourse in editorials and newspapers, much less in Utah, the Deseret News, in my eastern arrogance. So I sought this guy out. I didn't even know who wrote it at first, and I was through intermediaries, was led to Paul, who was extremely helpful. And it turned out that he had studied with somebody that I knew well at Bolt Law School. And he taught me a lot about what was going on with the Mormon Church in Utah. So I can't and won't disagree with what you just put on the table, Paul. But I will say this, is that I don't think my focus on the idealistic narrative contradicts at all what you just put out there. But if one wants to explore the pragmatism, the pragmatic aspects of things, well, then the story gets a whole lot more complicated and perhaps verges, I'll speak about the Catholic bishops, mm-hmm. to a certain maybe hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. Certainly the Catholic Church has heavy investments in the current, prevailing immigration policies. The church is in trouble, and Hispanic immigrants are fresh recruits, albeit ones that are turning their back on the church and becoming evangelicals. I'm here in Miami, and when I was here a few years ago, I learned talking to people in the Archdiocese how dependent the Miami Archdiocese in particular is on funding from the federal government for refugee services. It's a huge part of the church's budget here and elsewhere. It comes from providing services to immigrants. Now, is that a criticism? No. I'm glad the church is doing those things, but they are sort of. But they don't talk about that when they're espousing this more idealistic set of principles. So I agree with you, but I think to me the interesting story is probably sort of the interplay of those two things.
Thank you.
Mike Gerson, and then Karen. Tweet away, folks.
One of the most important interesting things I found in your presentation was how culture war issues get differently treated in these communities. And you talked about same-sex marriage as religious attendance being an indicator of a more conservative position, and religious attendance being an indicator of a less conservative position on immigration, right? I mean, I caught that correctly.
Okay. Right.
I can understand that in the context of maybe in the Catholic tradition where you have teaching on this topic, where the people who regularly attend might be getting teaching on this topic. I think that's probably a lot less likely in white evangelical settings. So is that distinction true in white evangelical settings as well? And can you explore just a little bit why that would be, what the explanation would be?
Well, I think it has to do with the different kinds of issues. And the sexual issues, what we call the new culture war issues. Well, we tend to call them the culture war issues, but they're relatively new in American politics. Are closely connected. I mean, attendance is a good measure, but it's not just regular attendance. It's also the beliefs that go along with regular attendance. And across almost all religious traditions, there is a more traditional view of marriage by people who tend to hold more traditional beliefs within that tradition. Now, I mean, that's a little bit convoluted way to put it, but that's because the impact of belonging doesn't completely go away, right? A regular mass attending Catholic's still a Catholic, right? And a regular church attending evangelical is still an evangelical. But and part of those traditional beliefs are connected to ideas about sexual behavior. So when issues like abortion and same-sex marriage came onto the scene, some of this was politics, but some of this was just the way people thought about it, that very traditional views were closely connected to one side of the debate. Whereas these other kinds of cultural issues, immigration being an example, there's a few other ones as well, really don't engage traditional beliefs as much. What they have to do with is the identity that people have by belonging to a particular group. And so it's interesting that in the case of these immigration data, that less frequent attending members of these religious traditions still have strong group identity. right? But it's not their religiosity that's engaged, but their group identity. This is actually not a new phenomenon. If you were to go back and look at voting behavior at voting behavior in the 1950s and 60s, you would find that worship attendance did not predict voting behavior at all, but group membership did. So, for instance, when John Kennedy was elected in 1960, Roman Catholics that attended Mass weekly were no more or no less likely to vote for John Kennedy than Roman Catholics who had, never darkened the door of a church in years. Because it was what was going on there was a group identification with a particular candidate that shared that identification. So I think there's two different ways that people's religion gets connected to these types of issues. One is group identity, and the other is religious beliefs and practices. Now, it could very well be that part of what's going on here is politics. And in the case of the new culture war issues, of course, there were lots of prominent leaders in both the evangelical and the Catholic community, a bunch of other communities that actually campaigned on these issues and tried to draw those connections. And not only on the right, of course, also on the more liberal side, more progressive side as well. It could be that, particularly in the evangelical community, we're seeing a little bit of that with the immigration issues, but it works the opposite way, where people may be hearing from their pastors or from other leaders about how there needs to be immigration reform, there needs to be greater acceptance. As some of you know, in the last couple of years, there's been kind of a united evangelical front to push for immigration reform, which, given some of the data we looked at today, is a little bit surprising, right? Because a lot of the people in the pews don't necessarily have those views. So it's possible, Mike, that part of this is that those regular attenders, even in evangelical churches, are hearing some of this message of how we need to have some changes in the policy, except it's moving against the prevailing opinion of the community. So, long, convoluted answer to a very good question.
Karen, while you're pulling the mic over, John, where is the Tea Party in this chart? Are they up there anywhere?
Well, the Tea Party isn't in that chart. The Tea Party is a political group.
No, I know it's not, but I just wondered where would you...
Well, Tea Party advocates are draw very heavily from a white Christian communities. So a significant portion of Tea Party adherents are evangelicals, but also they draw from mainline Protestants and from Catholics. The Tea Party overlaps with these white Christian communities, but doesn't overlap completely. Now, there are lots of evangelicals and lots of Catholics that don't regard themselves as part of the Tea Party. But,
and a lot of libertarians are Tea Party, right?
And some of you know, I'm sure, more about this than I do, but you can think of the Tea Party as sort of a faction among Republicans, but there's factions within the Tea Party. And there are social conservatives that are part of the Tea Party, but there's also libertarians, and they spend a lot of time not getting along with each other, as is the practice in American politics.
Karen? Karen Tolmonte.
Well, thank you for all of this. It's been great. And if anybody's following this on Twitter, we've been having Russell Moore and Ralph Reed have been weighing in on this conversation in absentia.
Are you going to ask their questions?
Well, one of them...
I give the floor now to Russell Moore.
Well, one of the questions that he wanted asked, although I'm really wondering now, if looking at your data, if it even applies, you know, he was wondering if there is a kind of coalition building on this issue with evangelicals and other groups that might carry over to other issues. But looking at your data, it really looks like there's going to be a real challenge for evangelical leaders to get the rank and file to sort of throw themselves into the immigration issue the way they have on other issues. I mean, do you, either one of you, see them, you know, coming in as a big political force on the immigration issue, despite what we're hearing from their leaders, again, the way they have on other issues?
I think it'll be very difficult. It's a real challenge to bring the people in the pews along with them. I think it's possible, but that goes into the details of what a policy reform would be. If it was perceived that there were strong border controls. You know, I think there might be a larger number of evangelicals and other white Christians that might join in that kind of. So it really is a case where I think the details matter a lot, because even setting certain conditions for people who are in this country to be able to have their relationship, their legal status normalized, is going against the prevailing sentiment of many people in those communities. Not everyone, of course, but to many people. So it has to be a good deal, if you will. So I think it's a real challenge. And this is not unusual in American politics for religious leaders to have a real challenge mobilizing their members behind something that they feel very strongly about. And even when you get something close to unanimity among leaders, it's still a challenge often to bring the followers along.
And I'll let Peter comment on it too. But Karen, was that question Ralph and Russell's?
Well, Ralph is just tweeting that, sorry about to bring in a...
That's why we're...
Well, Ralph's thesis on this is that evangelicals are just sort of so turned off by the law-breaking aspect of this that they, that's one of the reasons that it's hard to bring them along.
There may be a good bit of truth to that. One way to think about... Well, asking questions about these issues is very difficult, because with many people you get on the phone at dinner time, you know, the word illegal just jumps out, right? And, you know, it's hard for them to get past that. But I do think, particularly among evangelicals, but not exclusively with evangelicals, illegality seems like a threat.
Right. Yeah, his exact tweet is, mostly skeptical of amnesty/Washington undermining rule of law, evangelicals very welcoming of legal immigrants.
Yeah, and you know, the data we looked at shows that while there is even some skepticism of legal immigration among evangelicals, is much, much lower. The problem really is illegality. And, you know, I'm not sure that's because evangelicals are, quote-unquote, legalistic in their religiosity. I just think it's because in this particular debate, order is important to them. And they see lawbreaking as a source of disorder.
Peter, any comments?
Well,
Turno.
Yeah. I would just, a couple of things. Looking at John's data, it seemed to me almost on every question, white evangelicals were followed pretty directly by white Catholics. So rather close. Not to deflect your question, but yeah, there's a kind of similar dynamic going on. And then just to throw out a perspective that doesn't speak to the immediate political dynamics, but I've always been struck and have certainly argued, and this is part of what Paul Edwards and I have gone back and forth about, is that it's rather curious to me the way this dichotomy between legal and illegal has gotten defined. I think at some point Republicans allowed themselves to buy into this in a way that's, I suppose, on the one hand, makes some sense for them, but puts them in somewhat of a box. We never talk, of course, about if there's 11 million illegal immigrants in this country, there's at least 11 million employers who hired them illegally. And in fact, it's a crime to do so. It wasn't always a crime in our history. It became one in 1986. And we never talk about them, and certainly Republicans don't. But maybe they should. I can understand the politics of that. But I think there's a lack of realism to this discussion. On the other hand, I'm not at all convinced, and I can't prove this. I can certainly argue it and adduce some evidence, but I'm not at all convinced that the public is actually that more anxious about illegal immigration than it is about legal immigration. Clearly, the numbers defy what I just said, but that's the state of the debate. These categories, I think, are very confounding. If you ask and talk to people or look at the evidence of people who have talked to people about what really eats them about immigrants generally are illegal immigrants, they'll certainly cite illegal immigration right off the bat. Then they'll go on with a litany of things, some of which are true, some of which aren't, that illegal immigrants aren't learning English, you know, they're not paying taxes, all these kind of things. Some, like I said, some of which are true, some of which aren't. But then if you ask them about legal immigrants, they won't say they're here illegally, but they'll say the same things. They'll list the same litany. And I think that speaks to the fact that there are more basic, John kept referring to cultural dynamics, that's part of it. I would also, in my remarks, was trying to suggest, you know, what social scientists would call structural dynamics. I mean, that the fact that immigrants introduce certain levels of disorder in communities and pose challenges of sort of, you know, maintaining, you know, normal community dynamics. And that's true whether they're here illegally or legally. I mean, I think illegals pose particular challenges, but they're not all that different. So I just wanted to sort of throw that out, that this distinction that we all have come to rely on is an artifact of our politics, and I'm not sure how helpful it is.
William Salatin, you pull the mic over, please, and either ask your question or what the tweeters are asking you to ask.
I haven't been checking the Twitter feed. Sorry, I'm trying to live in this world right now. I wanted to reverse the question and ask a little bit about the attitudes of immigrants on some of these religious and moral issues. And we may not have any good data on it, but maybe we can extrapolate a little bit. So this is in the political context. So obviously there are a lot of Republicans who are very afraid that new Hispanic citizens will be a reliable Democratic voting bloc. And the argument on the other side is that Republicans can somehow use cultural issues to tap into conservative cultural views among this group. So looking at, John, your data on gay marriage, it looked like there's some basis for this argument, although somewhat limited. It looked like the white evangelicals were about 70% on gay marriage and about 15% among the unaffiliated, and then about 40 or 45 among the Hispanic group in Catholic Protestant. So there's some basis for that, it looks like, but, of course, in the larger context, a lot of polls have been showing shifts to the left on these cultural issues, not just on gay marriage over time, but which is moving very radically, but recently we saw polls on legalization of marijuana, death penalty, and maybe there's no correspondence, but it does look like there's somewhat of a liberalization pattern. So my question is, can the two of you put your heads together on this? Because, Peter, you have, I mean, first of all, What are the trend data on cultural issues within currently polled Hispanic and particularly recent Hispanic immigrants? I mean, has that been established at all, or is it just sort of the Hispanic group? And Peter, what do your data tell us about any changes in the nature of the folks who are coming here, and whether the data that we have on current Hispanic voters would resemble the future? Are there changes going on that make it so that we can't extrapolate?
The first thing to know about Hispanic immigrants is that, as many of you know, the term Hispanic is actually an American invention. And if you go talk to the Hispanic community, they don't think of themselves as Hispanics. They think of themselves as Mexicans or Cubans, or really it's more their national a nation of origin. And it's actually a very diverse stream of people. A large group of Mexican immigrants are religiously traditional. They're traditional Catholics. Some of them traditional evangelicals. Some traditional Catholics that come to the United States become evangelicals. There's an evangelism process. And they tend to be quite culturally conservative. But not all Hispanic immigrants are of that nature. Many of them are younger, upwardly mobile people, come from cities, or if they came from rural areas, they were anxious to get out of rural areas, just like my ancestors were anxious to get out of rural Oklahoma, you know, because they wanted to go to the big city where they could, you know, have more choices. So, you know, you have that kind of group as well. So if you look at the overall trend in Hispanics, just like in the entire country, there has been a liberalization on a number of these issues, and same-sex marriage being a very good example of that. But that tends to occur among younger, less religious, better educated members of these immigrant groups, just like it's those people among Catholics and evangelicals that are moving in that direction as well. So I think Republicans have some opportunities on cultural issues. My sense with Hispanic immigrants, I think that the relative power of cultural issues, though, is diminished, partly because of the liberalizing attitudes in the United States. But there are other ways that Republicans could appeal to this group. As Peter pointed out, many of these people come here for economic opportunity. And a lot of the Republican policy is about small business and economic opportunity might very well appeal to some of those folks. In these, I didn't put it in these data, but in these surveys that I was reporting on, a question was asked, would it help the Republicans or hurt the Republicans if they supported immigration reform? And among the Hispanic Christians, Protestants and Catholics, a large percentage said this would really help the Republicans. Now, does that mean all those folks are going to go out and vote Republican? I don't know that that would be the case. But it does suggest that the immigration issue may be a problem for some Republicans, at least, with Hispanic voters that might otherwise want to vote for them, be it for economic or for social issue reasons. But let me just say one more thing. There are religious distinctions within the Hispanic community. The evangelical Hispanics are more Republican than Hispanic Catholics. In most elections, they still vote majority Democratic, but at a much lower rate than Hispanic Catholics. So the part of the Republican outreach would be to go to evangelical Hispanics, right, rather than to Catholic Hispanics.
A quick point on that, Peter?
Yeah, quickly. I don't have a whole lot to add, but I would just I suppose chime in and point out that there are lots of other ways Republicans can appeal to Hispanics on immigration related issues that they haven't done much about. I mean, putting Mitt Romney to one side, and his unfortunate formulation of the issue. I mean, there's a whole raft of issues like promoting English language acquisition, around which lots of white Republicans could get behind, but certainly lots of Hispanics. We all talk a lot about English acquisition. We don't do much about it. If you've ever spent any time in ESL classes, my experience is that they're all inspiring failures. That are greatly underfunded, under sort of theorized, as it were. I mean, there's lots more one could do in much more imaginative ways if we put our minds to it and invested in it. And Hispanics would welcome that if it were done right. We also could do more about naturalization. Now, I understand Republicans have concerns about that, but there's ways of welcoming people here without necessarily opening our doors to ever more immigrants, which clearly is a problem for Republicans. And none of those kinds of opportunities seems to me like they're being explored.
David Rennie, you want to pull the mic up? And then Molly. Molly Hemingway, then Molly Ball, and then Michelle.
Questions. Just on cause versus correlation for Dr. Green, white evangelicals and their sort of outlier opposition, do you think that that is something within the theology of the evangelical faith, or is it simply that very conservative people tend to edge towards that denomination? And for Dr. Skerry, I mean, there's a lot of news reports about how, and the new kind of fashionable thing to write about in this debate is that evangelical church leaders are coming to Congress and lobbying in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. I'd just like to hear whether you think that's hype or whether something's going on and whether that represents a kind of broad trend or a sort of splintering within the evangelical movement.
Well, ordinary people don't spend a lot of time thinking about theology. They probably should, but they don't. But one of the reasons that evangelicals are conservative and is because their religious beliefs in our present context lead them on balance to favor more conservative policies. And the movement of evangelicals from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, which happened over the last 40 years, had a lot to do with religious beliefs. Now, I'm not sure that that was particularly sophisticated, but I do think it had to do with beliefs. And the new cultural issues were the leading edge of that, but it wasn't only that. I mean, there were lots of other things that other policies that were evangelicals slowly but surely found a Republican Party more congenial because it was a party that took more conservative positions. So I don't think there is a religious influence in there. Of course, if you try to track this in real time, the causality becomes very complicated because, if a particular campaign mobilizes a particular set of people, then for the next campaign, those people are different, right, because they voted for a particular candidate or so forth. So, you know, if you look over the grand sweep, I think there really is a connection between religious beliefs, perhaps in some ways unsophisticated versions of the theological statements. But the actual causal mechanism is very complicated.
Yes. Well, with regard to the recent evangelical initiatives, as I see this, this isn't particularly novel. This has been going on for some time. Back in the 90s, Ralph Reed worked with Grover Norquist and led similar efforts, successful efforts, in the immigration reform of 1996. Richard Land with the Southern Baptist led prominently and has argued up until very recently for liberalization. So has Richard Cizik with the National Association of Evangelicals. From where I sit, this is not recent. It's ongoing, long going. And I think that I don't know what the data look like. John could inform us all. How that has impacted attitudes among evangelicals toward immigration. My sense is not much, but I don't know. And to me, this just sort of reinforces what I was trying to suggest in my remarks, which is that there's very much an elite versus non-elite phenomenon going on here. Immigration and trade, I think, are, again, I would defer to John, are two issues where the spread between elites and non-elites I think are of widest of on any issues, and that speaks, I think, to in a whole dimension of immigration politics that doesn't always get talked about, which is that immigration doesn't benefit everyone in American society equally, and Washington elites. Us people sitting around these tables tend to look upon immigrants as a bonus. We go to the restaurants where there are waiters. We are at the hotels where there are waiters. We have, they provide services to us. But large numbers of Americans don't see it that way. They don't use their services. And they usually incorrectly see them as labor market competitors. But then they see them as competitors for resources or for community values or community stability. And it seems to me that the leaders of the evangelical churches are prone to this elite phenomenon, and that shouldn't be a surprise. And I think that's a great part of what we see playing out.
So a question here for John Green. You made the point that many of them feel that they take jobs, they take away opportunity. What does the data show about that, not about attitudes of religious people, but do they add to the market or do they take jobs from people? Do you have some data on that?
Well, it, like a lot of things, it's
because that would help the political consultants in this room, if there are any, to right. give a real strong answer on that.
Again, it depends on the nature of the immigrants. I think that a lot of people think that low-skilled immigrants. In these days, particularly from Mexico, do compete for lower-skilled jobs with Americans. But they also take jobs that Americans don't want. And so it's kind of a wash when you put the sort of big picture together. Higher skilled workers tend to they don't compete as much. What they do is they have synergies with existing workers in the United States. And so some of you may be aware of the strong argument that Silicon Valley has made for expanding legal immigration for people with certain kinds of skills. The argument is that if you bring more programmers and engineers to the United States, you won't displace the jobs of American programmers and engineers. What you'll do is expand those industries because we'll have more talent. So there's, you might argue that there's competition there, but at that level, those kinds of workers, this is seen actually as a net positive because it creates economic growth. And if you sort of flip that on its head, the assumption is that with low-wage jobs, you're not adding much to economic growth. So there's much more of a zero-sum game between the different competitors. So it really, Michael, it has a lot to do with the nature of the workers.
Yes, Peter, you comment on that. We need some real numbers on this before the next election. So if you gentlemen would hurry up and give us those numbers.
We'll do our best, Michael.
Well, I think, broadly speaking, the numbers are out there. There are a lot of economists, Giovanni Perry, George Borjas, have done a lot of work on this. And while they disagree, and this kind of builds on what John just said, putting it maybe a little differently, which is that the net benefit to the economy of prevailing immigration policies up to now, which is mostly slanted toward unskilled immigrants of varying sorts, that may be changing, we'll see, but is not as large as we tend to think. There's debates whether it's, 0.1% additional GDP. That's not very much. That's arguably negligible towards something that might be 2, 3, 4, 5 times larger than that, which would make it a half of a point of GDP. That's not a lot in the overall economy. What the big impact tends to be is not the size of the pie, but how the pie gets divided up. Certain sectors of the economy benefit greatly from immigration. Certain sectors of the population benefit greatly, Silicon Valley being one of them. Upper middle class educated people, again, coming back to what a point I made before, tend to benefit from it and see themselves as benefiting from immigration. So it's for these purposes, it's, if you will, not one economy. It sort of depends on where you are in the economy and what your, how you perceive immigrants, I think, relates to those kinds of economic outcomes.
Okay.
Which doesn't mean, by the way, that they always get perceived accurately. I would emphasize and reiterate that the kinds of ordinary Americans, Tea Party types, the people who showed up in John's data, invariably exaggerate the economic competition that they see mm-hmm. from unskilled immigrants. I would argue that there are other sources of competition and challenge from immigrants that, for a variety of reasons, people don't articulate, but they put all their chips on the economic labor market competition, which I think is exaggerated.
The religion and immigration story that I find most interesting is about Muslim immigration, and that's a long story, a long part of American history, but it seems like we're maybe in the second generation of significant Muslim immigration. My sense is that there's been a change from first generation a few decades ago to now in how Muslims talk about American identity. Leaders might have said in the near past that what was most important for Muslims is that they have a Muslim identity and that America is sort of a hostile place or whatnot. Now my sense is that Muslim public leaders are speaking very differently about it, that they are talking about being more engaged in American politics, being more engaged in the community and whatnot. Do you have anything on that, Dr. Scarry, is this a change that's happening, and what are some of the consequences of that, not only in terms of how maybe
Dr.
older...
Dr. Scarry has a book coming out on this, so he does have something on that.
Yeah, the consequences not only of Muslims maybe changing their own views on this, but maybe pushback among other groups, or just anything on that topic.
You're writing a book on this, Peter.
Yeah.
Go ahead and tell the people.
Molly's, I think, pretty much on target. If we're talking about Muslim immigrants, there has been a big shift. For much of their time here, up to 9/11, they not only viewed America as hostile, many of them also viewed it as seductive and dangerously seductive, and spent as much time urging their young people and each other to avoid assimilating. And what's interesting, I think, about Muslims is that it's avoid assimilation not for the reasons that Hispanic immigrants or Mexican immigrants would avoid it out of some sense of their culture, their heritage, but they viewed this as a question of saving their souls, that as Muslims they shouldn't even be here, properly understood, much less adapt to this society. That was what their leaders were telling them. Certainly in the 70s and 80s and 90s, it had begun to change, but 9/11 really turned that around and seems to have persuaded Muslim leaders and many of their followers, not all, that it was time to embrace America, if only because they had to protect themselves. That's what they're busily doing now. The irony of that story is that, to my mind, is that what went before, I think, is largely forgotten by Muslims, so that younger Muslims today aren't very mindful, or even their elders aren't very mindful, of how America was seen before 9/11 as this sort of seductive place. And while they're fighting now and trying to claim their rights as Americans, they're doing that in a context which... And in a way that seems to deny large parts of their own cultural conservatism. You don't find Muslim leaders or even young people at universities, young Muslims, talking about their hostility or their anxiety about homosexuality, which is difficult to deal with in Islam, or sexual relations outside of marriage, or any of the cultural issues that were very salient to them before 9/11, all that's been sort of put to one side with a focus on claiming their rights as American citizens. There's a lot of reasons for that, but I think it's an unnatural posture for Muslims that will sooner or later have to change. But that's kind of the state of play.
When will your book be out, Peter?
Hopefully... sometime next year.
And the publisher is?
To be determined.
And the working title is? To be determined.
Yeah, I haven't got one for you.
Okay, the book is by Peter Skerry.
Yeah.
To be determined. Molly Ball, you're up next. Thank you.
What I was going to say, but responding to this idea that the legal versus illegal distinction is really important. John, it seemed to me that your first few charts rebutted that notion that when people are saying immigrants threaten our way of life, immigrants are a burden on society, they're not making that distinction, and they seem to see... I wonder how much of this you think is and also has been historically about a fear of the other, and particularly about... white people specifically fearing the erosion of their majority status, since that seems to be an undercurrent of a lot of the data that you've presented.
Well, you know, I think you're right. The initial one of the reasons I liked those questions that I presented is because they're general statements, and as you can imagine, those can get quite complicated when you ask a question that doesn't have a word like newcomer or immigrant, but actually identifies a particular group, right? Because some groups are perceived as much more threatening than other groups. But it is interesting. This gets to Peter's point, and I wish I had articulated as well as he did, that we have this background suspicion, skepticism of immigration, but the debate we're having has drawn this distinction between legal and illegal. And I think that that, and partly because of the questions pollsters ask, but partly because of the way elites present the debate, the public has picked up on that distinction, and that distinction has resonated with them. But, you know, as some of the other data suggested, there's not as much skepticism or opposition to illegal immigration as illegal immigration, but there still are, you know, significant numbers of these groups that are concerned about this. You know, you can describe this in a lot of different ways. I do think it is the fear of the other, right? If you identify with a particular group and you draw boundaries around your group and other groups do the same thing, then there's a certain fear and tension. Another way to look at it is that that's the flip side of American pluralism. To pick up on one of Peter's themes, many of us tend to celebrate American pluralism, right? The most diverse nation in the world, you know, the nation made up of all nations. And, you know, that's a very comforting narrative. But there's another side to pluralism, right? Is that groups don't get along with each other. And that's not a new phenomenon. The groups are a little different, but that goes back historically. And many of these groups of white Americans who now fear non-whites, their ancestors feared each other, right? You know, so that I think there is that dynamic, and that's a lot of what has to do with, you know, the politics of belonging, right? The part of belonging is that you don't belong to other groups, right? And there's tension with them.
Michelle, you want to comment on it, Peter? And then Michelle, you're going to take us into the break. So I want to tell the cameraman that Michelle is over here, and you'll want to get pictures of her from over there. And our man with the mic, this next person up, is here. Are you going to comment, Peter?
If I could.
Please.
In some ways I would echo what John just said. I'll put it a bit more strongly. We're going through, you know, enormous changes, not just in America, but globally. And there are all sorts of examples about the way large numbers of Americans express their anxieties about these changes. And they often get put and articulated in ways that, you know, lend themselves to, othering, you know, to that kind of narrative. I do resist those kinds of interpretations because it seems to me they are conducive to particularly people who study and write about these things to in a kind of way othering Americans and sort of that's a disease that they have, and it fits into a kind of racial prejudice kind of perspective that I just find too many alternative explanations that sort of supplement that kind of interpretation. Whether we're talking about cultural change, which I take to be real, not just sort of ephemera or another excuse for prejudice. If immigrants come here and have different ways of doing things that people feel threatened by, I want to kind of look at those and see exactly what that's all about. Or again, the kinds of, you know, more concrete challenges that immigrants pose, labor market competition, or if, you know, you live in a struggling marginal blue-collar neighborhood and suddenly the house next door to you is occupied, that used to have, you know, a nice old couple, is suddenly occupied by, you know, 12 Central American guys who work two jobs, have, you know, 8 cars, and play lots of soccer on what used to be a lawn next door to you. Well, you know, is that othering? Is that racism? Or is that just sort of like good old-fashioned, what's happening to my neighborhood? I live in Newton, Massachusetts, an upper-middle-class community, where if you want to, you know, build a bike path down an old railroad bed, you suddenly find out that this is the opening wedge of the end of Western civilization. So I resist those kinds of racial interpretations. And try to focus more on these more concrete manifestations of places where people feel pinched and squeezed and competed against.
Very, very helpful. Michelle Cottle is next.
All right. Well, I have just along the same lines as what Molly's looking at, so I guess probably I'll look at it more with a question about methodology. We all know people lie to pollsters, and we all know people lie to themselves because they know they're not supposed to be either racist or culturally kind of nativist or whatever. What methods do we have for drilling down into things like what I do suspect is something of a false distinction between the illegal and legal complaints? I mean, for instance, we used to know that if you wanted to find out what people really thought about having a black president or a woman president, you didn't ask them if they were ready for it. You asked them if their neighbor was ready for it. And you'd get wildly different results. Kind of what can we do or what are we doing to kind of pick apart this sort of thing?
Well, it's really very difficult. And I have to give my colleagues at the Pew Research Center and other polling organizations a lot of credit for being very aware of what you're talking about, how difficult it is to measure these things. And that's why there's the wording is sometimes a bit elliptical. Right? They're trying to get people to feel comfortable to answer honestly. And there are indirect ways of measuring that. And you just gave a really good example. Back in 2008, there was a lot of concern among pollsters that a lot of Americans were really not prepared to vote for an African-American presidential candidate for racial reasons. And so one of the questions that would be asked is, what about the people in your community? Would people in your community be willing to do this? Well, it turned out what those experiments showed, I mean, they weren't true experiments, but those new kinds of questions showed was that, well, there was a lot of unrevealed prejudice. The unrevealed prejudice wasn't quite as big as a lot of people thought. And, of course, Barack Obama was elected, right? And he was elected with a lot of white votes from people that one might have suspected based on past surveys would maybe not being entirely honest. But this is a very extremely difficult thing to get at. And, that you know, the technical term for it is social desirability effects. And yesterday we were talking about the rise of the nuns, the increase in the unaffiliated population. And among scholars, there's a sense that some of that increase might not be because there's more unaffiliated people. It's that people feel more comfortable saying they're unaffiliated. And that, in fact, those same people, maybe 10, same sort of people 10, 15 years ago, would have said, well, I'm kind of a Catholic, right? But now they feel comfortable saying I'm really not anything. So social desirability effects are really an important thing. I think in the end, survey research can't answer that question, and we have to move to other types of things, to focus groups, to in-depth interviews, to participant observation methodologies, because you can only do so much. See, a telephone survey, or if you do it on the Internet, it's really a conversation between the interviewer and the interviewee.
Not in my house.
And, you've heard it right here, a Luddite person. But it's a and you know, there's some limit to what you can do in that kind of conversation. You'd have other kinds of conversations to really get at the deeper attitudes that people have.
Peter, add that quickly.
Yeah, quickly. I
do people lie to you when you take surveys?
My wife does, but sure. I don't do surveys. I do interviews, and sure, people lie, but. What you do try to get behind that is you also look at behavior, and it seems to me that if you and this kind of reminds me of the conversation yesterday about you know our whether we're forgetful or not as a people and how conscious we are of history. It seems to me, and I kind of suggested this in my question yesterday, that we are rather forgetful, and sometimes that has its virtues. I mean, if you look at what happened to German immigrants around World War I, which I was talking to Molly about last evening, that was a pretty reprehensible episode in our history. I think it has a more complicated story than we acknowledge. But then, you know, 5-6 years later, when we invoked rigid country quotas in our immigration law, we toted up the number of Germans in America and established a quota for them that was very high, like it was for other Western European countries. And all that Sturm und Drang around World War I was quickly forgotten. it may not have been entirely forgotten by the Germans, but the people who were giving them a hard time seem to have forgotten about it. And then if bringing it up to today, if you look at the levels of intermarriage between Hispanics and non-Hispanics, which I think by the second, third generation, we're talking about crowding 50%. I haven't looked at the numbers recently. Outmarriage, that's typically to non-Hispanic whites. To me, that suggests whatever kind of reaction we're getting to immigrants, again, is not deep-seated hostility, animosity, racism toward the other. It's these kinds of situational factors that can be negotiated and overcome. So I'll stop there.
Okay, this question just springs to mind as to whether, you've talked a lot about how different religious groups feel about maybe the kind of negative or the threat aspects of immigrants and so forth, or even for some the positive aspects of adding more talent and skill and good things to the nation. My question, though, is that for some religious groups, evangelism or service to others are such as supposed to be part of their calling, and many times they've had to travel to distant lands to do this kind of work, and all of a sudden people from the distant lands are coming here. Do any of these groups sort of see that as a great opportunity? They, you know, welcoming these people from other lands so that they can fulfill this calling, whether it's of you know, service in terms of material needs or service in terms of sharing their faith with these people or this kind of thing. Does anybody sort of see it in that kind of light?
Oh, yeah, a lot of people do. And you, we talked a little bit about it earlier with Paul's question about the views of the LDS Church, where there's kind of institutional interests. But the present immigration debate has created some really interesting dynamics, for instance, in the evangelical community, where there is a lot of interest in proselytizing. They would call it evangelizing, but, you know, the academic term is proselytizing, and have had a lot of success in immigrant communities, particularly Hispanic immigrants. Now, you know, and some of that's the fruit of evangelizing efforts in Latin America in a previous period of time. So, you know, so some of the interest in immigration issues has to do with these opportunities. And, you know, there have been similar debates in different denominations about the service component. Here's a real opportunity, you know, to share Christ's love with people who are strangers, right? And they may be poor and they may be discriminated against, but they're certainly strangers. They're new to this community. So, you know, I think there's a lot of discussion and debate among within religious communities about how does the church or the religious organization live out its mission, and that occurs side by side with a lot of these tensions, right, with the new groups and some of the problems that occur in those communities. So it's a really interesting one. Where I noticed it most fully, I spoke at a conference of Hispanic evangelists. And evangelists, and it was interesting because they had this great complaint about their white colleagues, saying why aren't you with our community on this? I mean, you know, we collaborate to save souls, but you know, then on other areas we don't collaborate, and you know, we find this distressing, which is just, it was really interesting to me. And you know, it, as often happens at those kinds of meetings, there was some of the white evangelical evangelists were you know, appropriately sorrowful, you know, that they really needed to cooperate more. So I do think there's a lot of tension within religious communities about how one deals with this issue. And you know, it's like Peter was mentioning earlier, there are other issues that have similar problems. And an example might be trade. You know, trade can help communities flourish. There's real opportunities for churches to be part of economic development. On the other hand, it does displace industries, and it does create problems. So, you know, I do think that there's a, you know, not just you know, the negative tensions, but there's tensions between the negatives and the positives.
Fred Barnes? Pull the mic, Gary. Go.
Agree with this. Americans always seem to be, and maybe not a majority, but it seems like a majority, always oppose immigrants who haven't gotten here.
Who haven't what?
Or just beginning to come.
Oh, haven't gotten
like the
here.
Irish, even before the Civil War, and so on through Hispanics today. And yet, once they get here, then Americans are congratulating themselves on our being a nation of immigrants. And yet we continue the cycle where there's an awful lot of, for a nation of immigrants to oppose immigrants who are coming, it seems awfully odd to me. Did either of you have any thoughts about that?
That's a Michael Barone's argument, isn't it, Fred, in his new book? Michael Barone's argument in his new book about immigration?
Yeah.
That these groups, we oppose them until they get here.
Yeah, right. Well, I think Mike's right. Yeah, he knows a lot more about immigrants than I do.
Well, I guess my response would be, and has been, well sure, that's part of our history, but it's the conclusions that one draws from that. Usually the conclusion is, therefore, what's the big deal? And I guess I kind of resist that because it seems to look past the travail that is at hand. And I'm just, you know, it's also the case that the kinds of reactions that we got to immigrants, the Americans expressed in the past, aren't necessarily the same in their origins. Aren't the same as we're experiencing today. I mean, there's some similarities. There's, you know, intergroup, you know, ethnic tensions and conflicts. Okay, but generally that perspective, to me, is a way of changing the conversation. I mean, it seems to me today we are in the middle of some big and challenges that in a period of greatly increasing inequality, and lots of Americans feel squeezed. Are immigrants the cause of that? No, not in most cases, but are they connected to it? Yes. Have our leaders done a very good job of interpreting it to the mass of ordinary Americans? No, I don't think so. I don't think, certainly academics haven't done a very good job, although I don't consider academics our leaders necessarily. But it seems to me a way of kind of assuming that this is all going to work out in the end. It's kind of Whiggish, you know? And I resist that because I'm not convinced it's all going to work out if we don't attend to it more carefully. And it sort of assumes a kind of automatic sort of, you know, sort of writing of things. And I don't think we can assume that at all.
Let me pick up on Peter's point there. The if you will, the flip side of these waves of immigration is the process of assimilation. And we've talked here today about how we have sort of pleasant stories about how this takes place. And but, you know, even a casual reading of history suggests that the assimilation process has often been very difficult. And, you know, and at different eras, the assimilation process has had different problems and different characteristics. You know, the assimilation of Catholics into American society, let alone American public life, was very, very hard to do. And partly that had to do because Catholics had to change, not just Catholic immigrants and their children, but the worldwide Roman Catholic Church had to change some of its perspectives. But of course, the then Protestant majority in the United States had to adapt as well to those kinds of adjustments. So the, you know, I think there is a process of assimilation. What makes it particularly tricky to compare one era to another is what people are assimilating to keeps changing. I remember talking to my grandmother, who's passed away a number of years ago, but she was utterly amazed that people would, non-Irish Catholics, would celebrate St. Patrick's Day. That just seemed to her like the oddest thing. She thought it was a very good thing, but it was a very, very odd thing, because when she was growing up, that was still a symbol of the separateness of Irish Catholics. And so, you know, you could imagine if that story were to play out in the future, there'd be a time in which we all celebrate Cinco de Mayo, right? Because it's just, you know, it's but the problem is that the society that eventually accepted St. Patrick's Day, right, as a sort of general holiday, is not the same society anymore, right? It's a society that's profoundly changed by the very assimilation. So, you know, I think assimilation is very important, and I think Peter's right that those types of issues really have to be attended to. There isn't, there are patterns, but they're not always the same pattern.
Andy Ferguson and then Erica over here.
Okay.
Now, Erica, then Andy Ferguson.
I was wondering if either of you could elaborate on this concept of legality. I'm trying to think through when somebody raises that as a concern that an unauthorized immigrant has broken the law and has to somehow make redress for that. Crossing the border, unauthorized entry is a civil crime, but beyond that, I don't think we have any data showing that there's a high rate of further illegal behavior. If anything, I think the opposite. Economic migrants work. They don't cause crimes at a higher rate than the population at large. So what's your understanding of when somebody says that's their concern? What are they? Are they not seeing that data, or are they?
Oh, they're not looking at data. I mean, this is an impression. And a lot of the people that we have interviewed, but also people that I've talked to, look at, you know, particularly the southwestern border as an area with a lot of disorder. And many people, and I think there's probably some truth to that. But if you, and a lot of that's laid at the feet of immigrants, who and some of them legal immigrants, right? Or people who are here, maybe they're not immigrants, but they're here with visas, and you know they're crossing the border in a legal fashion. But the breaking of the law in terms of coming to reside in the country is often linked, probably inaccurately, with things like drug smuggling and weapons and, you know, the drug cartels and all kinds of other problems, including the very distressing stories about immigrants who are mistreated when they come into the country. So I think to a lot of people, this just looks like a bunch of disorder. And the thing that it seems to have, the biggest piece of it, or the most salient piece to them, seems to be illegal immigrants. But, you know, there's some pretty good evidence that many of the folks who have come to this country without documents are not particularly disorderly people, you know, and it may be that their presence causes some kinds of disorder in terms of public services and so forth. And as Peter was pointing out, some of these people plan on going back. They may not actually ever make it back, but they plan to. So they have a different, have strong incentives to not want to get in trouble, right? So, I think that's where the perception comes from, is because of the overlay of these different kinds of disorder.
Peter?
This is something I've wrestled with. First thing I would say is with regard to crime rates among immigrants generally, which is all we really have data for. You're right in one sense. Immigrants have crime rates that are roughly equivalent to what the general population is. But I'm not sure that ends the discussion. I've often found that among immigration analysts, it tends to, you know, their conclusion is, well, so what's the problem? Well, it seems to me it's an open question whether we want immigrants, legal or illegal, to exhibit the same proclivity to crime that we have. Maybe we have higher standards for them. That doesn't seem to me totally unreasonable. But I'll leave it at that on that point. With regard to the whole question of about legality, illegality, I spend a lot of time with Border Patrol agents along the southwest border just before and after kind of 9/11. And I was struck that it was almost a law of nature. Every single Border Patrol agent I ever spent any time talking to, and I spent a lot of time talking to a lot of them, they all invariably would say two things. They would all assert very defensively, volunteer, that we're federal law enforcement agents, and we're just as good as any other law enforcement agents that the federal government employs. We're armed, which was not because they're trigger happy, because that's status and pay. We're just as good as the FBI, and it's important for you to know that. Then the second thing they would invariably volunteer, usually later into the evening after things had sort of died down after the evening rush of illegal immigrants across the border, they would mention that, you know, if I were in their shoes, the illegal shoes, the undocumented shoes, I'd be doing the same thing as them. I'd be finding a way to come here and better things for myself and my family. Well, that sort of tells you a lot. These are people who were preoccupied with their low position on the law enforcement totem pole, telling you they're as good as FBI agents, also telling you that they would, if they were in their shoes, they'd be committing the crimes that they're supposed to be enforcing the law against. You don't find cops, at least even in Boston, where I come from, you don't typically find cops saying, if I was in that guy's shoes, I'd be, you know, dealing drugs or robbing banks. But you do find Border Patrol agents in that somewhat contradictory posture. So we're dealing with something really conflicted here. And the best I can do to try to directly answer your question is that, and this comes back to my conversations with Paul Edwards, which is that I think the way to think about this is that, you know, what's legal or not isn't prudently thought of as something that's sort of like, something that gets enacted by a legislature or ruled by a court. That's a very formalistic notion of what's legal and illegal. I think a more useful way to think about it is that law is embedded in social ties and social relations, and that, you know, when the Supreme Court ruled on busing in Brown versus Board of Education, it was mindful that it issued a dictum, but it had to work its way into the body politic, which is why it allowed lots of time for that to happen, and people had to be persuaded. And it seems to me that what's going on with our tensions over illegal immigration is that it's not so much, even though people articulate it this way all the time, that those people broke the law. It's more that is manifested to people on a routine or daily basis where they live and work. That, and this may be where I'm not sure I would disagree with John, but he put it in a way that I might disagree with, which is that these are disorderly people, not because they're inherently disorderly, but, you know, you've got large numbers of especially young males congregating together. If they're Hispanic or they're college, you know, white college boys, you're going to have problems. It was true in mining camps, not that there were college boys in mining camps at the turn of the, you know, 19th century, or, you know, summer camps today. You've got populations of people who are in specific kinds of situations that act out and sort of pose challenges to the prevailing sort of mode of behavior. That doesn't explain all of illegal immigration, but that's a big chunk of it. And that's why in my remarks I kept alluding to ways in which people come here, they don't plan to stay, they pull their kids out of school, they go home for long holidays at Christmas. They, you know, overcrowd themselves in apartments because they're saving money to go home. All those kinds of things speak to ways in which they're doing things that strain the heretofore common understanding of the way things are getting done. And that's, I think, what people, even though they wouldn't articulate it this way, feel what's wrong with illegal immigrants. That's what's illegal about them, that they're doing things in a way that threaten the ordinary conduct of business.
Andy Ferguson is next, right next to her.
We've touched on this a little bit before.
Pull the mic in front of your mouth, Aaron.
John used a phrase that I hear in these debates all the time, which is jobs that Americans won't do. Do we know what those jobs are? Is there evidence that people who are already here won't do them? And on the other side, jobs that I assume Americans would want to do. For example, in Washington now, the building trades are completely Hispanic, and mostly Central American, I gather. Now, surely those are great jobs, I mean, relatively speaking. How is it that those jobs, or especially in the building trades, have become, in certain areas, monolithically Hispanic? And then on the other side, there are jobs that just Americans refuse to do. I mean, I don't know what that would be. Is it mowing lawns or?
Peter, do you want to take a crack at that?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
You want me to take a crack?
Yeah.
Thanks.
I'm not sure I've got a well thought through scenario for this. It's a good question. I think on the one hand, part of what we're talking about is which Americans, right? And when you mention Washington, D.C., the obvious group that one thinks about that seemingly didn't get those jobs, apparently didn't get those jobs, is African Americans. And that gets into tricky territory. But it seems to me that there's a lot of evidence, and I mean research evidence, not just sort of casual observations, that employers find immigrant, and in this case Hispanic immigrant workers, easier to deal with than African Americans. And some of that is attitudinal in terms of what the expectations are on the part of African American workers in terms of how they get dealt with on job sites.
Despite the language barrier also?
Well, it depends on the job. If you want somebody to, you know, do sales at a hardware store, if you can't speak English, that's a problem. But if you need somebody to be a laborer on a work site, it's not so much of a problem. But it also has to do with sort of structural factors that immigrants come here through networks. And if you hire one immigrant, you typically get plugged in to a network where they will willingly produce their brother, their cousin, who will also be willing to work for you. And you have a means of exerting some influence over them, because if one guy screws up, then you've got some people to hold accountable. Those networks don't work the same way for African Americans. They're not as strong. And I think this is a big problem. I don't report this news gladly because I think I noticed John's data showed African American support for immigration at what I took to be higher levels than I would have thought. I haven't looked at the numbers lately. But I think one of the difficult aspects of our prevailing immigration policy is its impact on African Americans. I think they've been disproportionately negatively impacted. When we talk about unskilled people with less than high school education, that's over, you know, disproportionately African Americans. It's very hard to get their leaders to, you know, acknowledge and talk about that, who generally are part of the pro-immigration coalition. So that's part of an answer. I also think there are jobs that Americans, for not just economics but for sociological reasons, just won't see themselves doing. That what, however high the unemployment rate has been in the last few years, large numbers of Americans haven't been willing at prevailing wage rates to go out and pick strawberries. And I don't think, I can't prove this, and I'm sure an economist who are here would violently disagree with me to the extent that economists ever get violent, that I don't think they would go out and pick strawberries if the rates were greatly increased, because that's hard, unpleasant work that Americans just don't see themselves doing. And there are alternative ways of making money, like unemployment. I think better answers should be forthcoming, but that's my best shot.
I would just, have any comment?
The only thing I'd want to add,
and
is
then we
that,
have one more question.
That there, when you say it, you know, and you're right in the debate. It's, you know, jobs that Americans don't want. Well, a lot of that has to do with jobs that are unpopular. It may be under other circumstances people would want those jobs, right? But they're seen as unpopular. Many of them are arduous. You know, they're dirty jobs of one kind or another. But then also, a lot of it has to do with the pay. And, you know, in the western part of the United States, where there's lots of migrant labor, and there's been migrant labor there for, you know, decades and decades. It's not a new thing. A lot of that farming is profitable, and sometimes very profitable, because they can hire low-wage workers. And there may be a lot American citizens who wouldn't want to do that at that wage. And one could imagine, I don't know about picking strawberries, that might always be labor intensive, but at other points in our history when labor became expensive, then capital was deployed in agriculture.
Right.
Well, it may very well be that in some areas of agriculture right now, as long as there's a cheap source of labor, capital won't be deployed. And so there are lots of people who have other alternatives and wouldn't want to take that job. So I think, you know, maybe a better way to say is there's unpopular jobs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have actually two more questions. And Elizabeth and then Mindy Bells, and then we'll go for lunch. And we'll end our conference. Elizabeth.
Thanks. I wanted to ask a bit more broadly about religion and immigration outside of the United States, even outside of the Western Hemisphere. And just I'm hoping for really any insight or data you all can point to for these kinds of things. Like, I think of Christian, Orthodox, Catholic women in Ethiopia who are adopting Muslim practices to go get domestic labor jobs in Saudi Arabia, et cetera. Or I think of...
Is this a trend?
Well, it's happening. I mean, I've heard about it. But or how, say, different religious communities in India. What is the discussion in some of these other places about religious interaction and dialogue about immigration and how that works?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I mean, I know it's a problem in lots and lots of countries, but I don't know how different religious communities are responding abroad.
Peter, do you know?
I'm afraid I'm not much more help.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Maybe you
that's
have
okay.
the answer.
If you have any thoughts just on who might be resources for something like that.
International immigration.
Yeah, international immigration and religion questions.
Nothing leads to mind, but let me ponder it out.
Thanks.
We will be sending a list of questions. Mindy, you get the last question of our time together, so no pressure.
In response to Jennifer's question, you know, the three largest refugee resettlement agencies are Catholic Relief Services, Lutheran Refugee Services, and I believe World Relief. Those are the three largest in this country. And so there is this robust effort, I think, to take care of strangers, if we want to call it that, among Christian groups. And you alluded to this earlier, this confusion that that we have of dealing with refugees and dealing with immigrants. I hear this all the time because people will lump the problems of refugees in with the problems of immigration, and yet we know that refugees get here a very different way than immigrants do. And so I guess all of that leading to a little bit of a frustration that I had looking at your categories, as helpful as they are, that white evangelicals becomes this very large, and I'm speaking as one, so I'm maybe taking it personally. But white evangelicals become, and I don't see myself up there, is what I would say, and so become this very large group, whereas I think if you broke that down, as we've been trying to do in our own reporting, we've realized that too often we are covering the debate on immigration instead of covering the immigrants and immigration per se. And if you break that white evangelical group down, you begin to see that white evangelicals living in border states are going to have different views than white evangelicals living in the middle part of the country, and that suburban and urban evangelicals are going to have different views too, depending on their experiences. All of that to say, is there data that breaks down what you presented, which I found so helpful, but I also find, you know, we're not quite getting at where African Americans figure into this debate. I'm not sure we're quite getting at where white evangelicals really are in this debate. I think that what we've seen in our reporting is a much more diversity of opinion than what I saw in that data. And I realize that's the difference between data and reporting. But I'm just wondering if there is an attempt to do that, because there seem to be a lot of misperceptions about what immigration actually is. And you've highlighted some of those today, and what immigrants actually do once they're here, that kind of thing.
You know, the religious categories we looked at in the data today are really very crude, really crude. And I say that as somebody who spent his entire career trying to measure religious communities very, very accurately. But some of that's just the nature of the instrument we're using. I think the virtue of those surveys was that we got kind of up-to-date general opinion, you know, that surveys that were conducted this year. So we have a sense of where people's opinions are at the moment. But the cost of that is there's not very much detail. But there have been scholars that have either aggregated surveys or have done much more in-depth studies. And they do pick up on some of the nuances that you're talking about. You know, there's a good bit more diversity within those communities. You know, the central tendencies that we see in these survey data are still there, but there's a lot more nuance and a lot more detail. But it's also important to remember that, you know, this is measures of public opinion. Within a religious community, they're all different. There's public opinion, but then there's clergy, and there's activists, and there are volunteers, and there are different kinds of organizations. And this kind of data doesn't deal with those sorts of things. But other data that does shows the kind of nuance that you're talking about, that lots of congregations, evangelical congregations, Catholic congregations, are engaged in various kinds of relief efforts that you wouldn't be able to measure in this kind of data. But that gets to Peter's point, and I really think Peter probably answered your question better. I do think among people I've interviewed in congregations, there is this confusion between refugees and immigrants. And one place where those two things seem to overlap is the idea of relief, because many of those organizations also engage in disaster relief, you know, around the world, including in the United States. And so from their operational point of view, and I'm probably overstating this, but they tend to see people in need. And the distinctions are a little less important sometimes than the need that needs to be addressed. But what that means is there's a certain degree of confusion as to what they're about. Peter?
I would agree with what John just said, and just maybe hit a little even harder on the confusion, and just take the occasion to say again what I kind of said in passing in my remarks, which is that confusion in this case is really, in my view, to be laid at the feet of refugee advocates, whom I've talked about talk to about this confusion, and when they're being straightforward, which they have been when I've talked to them, will admit that even though any opinion poll I've ever seen is more receptive to refugees relative to immigrants than that. They that's an advantage they're prepared to put to one side, and more than happy to throw in their lot with immigration reform advocates, because they feel however popular refugee issues are among the American public, they're not that popular and they need allies. So that's an advantage that they're willing to kind of take a pass on. So they're promoting this confusion, in essence, it seems to me. I might do the same thing if I were them, but I'm not sure. So they cede that high ground. And then I guess this is just a chance for me to say, again, that your question is one reason why I tend to resist attitudinal or ideological interpretations of reactions to immigrants, because it's invariably very context-specific. It's not even just immigrants. It's, you know, which immigrants, high-skill, low-skill, or, you know, from where. I mean, we're talking a lot about Hispanic immigrants. That's even worthy of a little of attention. For all the talk about diversity in America today and preoccupation with diversity, the fact is that our current influx of immigrants are probably less diverse, arguably less diverse than they've ever been, because we have this huge preponderance of this one sort of agglomerated group that we and they now call themselves Hispanics. That's something we haven't quite dealt with before. But putting that to one side, reactions to Asian immigrants, I think, are much more positive, not uniformly, but much more positive for a lot of different reasons. And it matters whether we're talking about, you know, central Maine versus, the border area in Texas or the Central Valley of California. So it just is a reminder to me that all these contextual factors really need to be looked at very carefully. And it sounds to me that's the kind of reporting you're doing, which sounds good. But it does lend itself to a really different perspective than when we're talking about national policy and overall patterns.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the success of this program is because we get such quality speakers like Professor Scarry and Professor Green. And it's also a success because of you and your contributions to this. And we're very grateful for your participation. We're always grateful when we write you and you say, yes, I'm coming. We're also grateful when you say yes and you stay there and say yes and end up showing up. Sometimes it doesn't happen for various reasons, so we're delighted you could be here, and thank you so much, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the spring, hopefully. Thank you.